From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect Weekend. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today on the show, we speak with Milwaukee Mayor Tom Barrett about the recent protests. Then, how marching and the use of tear gas against protesters could increase the spread of coronavirus.
If you think about it logically, if tear gas is being thrown, probably the first reaction is to wipe your eyes, perhaps to remove your mask or move it around. And it also creates chaos where people might bump into each other. They might touch each other more. They may be running.
Bubbler Talk examines death in nursing homes due to COVID-19 outbreaks. Plus, we speak with a local photographer about what it's like to capture the ongoing protests in Milwaukee.
These protests truly are peaceful. There's truly no doubt about that. And I march alongside these people with my camera in hand to show the police that we're not afraid to document what happens here.
Lake Effect Weekend is next, but first the news. This is Lake Effect Weekend from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. We're only halfway through 2020, and already our community has faced so many surprising and extraordinary challenges. A global pandemic has shut down businesses, kept our communities in isolation, and brought our economy to a screeching halt. Over the past couple weeks, after some high-profile incidents of police brutality, Milwaukeeans and Americans around the country took to the streets, demanding justice, reform, and accountability. And through all of this, we've been looking to our leaders for guidance, many of us with hopeful and critical eyes. Milwaukee Mayor Tom Barrett has been both criticized and praised for his actions during this pandemic and the mounting protests. He spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers about the issues facing the city.
Well, Mayor Tom Barrett, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
I'm happy to be with you.
So as you know, protests have erupted in a lot of different communities throughout the Milwaukee area, decrying police brutality. You actually marched alongside some of these protesters. What led to that decision?
Well, I think that what we're seeing right now is a fundamental shift in our society as to how we view the relationship between the community and our police departments. And I think it's very, very important to listen to people. And part of what I wanted to do was listen to people, listen to young people, see what their concerns are, see what we can do as a city to make the reforms that are necessary to move us forward. And I say that knowing full well that a lot of what needs to be done is out of the direct control of the city, that there is the state that obviously comes into play. There are union contracts. There are court decisions. But clearly, the city has a very, very important role to play to improve police-community relations. And I want to be part of that, and I will be part of that.
Well, and that gets to a question that I have. You know, a lot of people have credited the death of George Floyd for sparking these protests, but Milwaukee has its own history of police brutality. And we see this pretty typical cycle. People protest, the city says it's going to change, and then nothing really feels like it changes, and people go out and protest once again. Why should we expect this moment to be different?
I think we should not only expect this moment to be different, I think we should demand that this moment is different. But I think what many people don't recognize, and I'll just talk about a couple of things that we have done here locally to try to deal with these issues. And I go back to the Frank Jude case, which occurred shortly after I became the mayor of the city of Milwaukee. And at that time, after I started seeing the reports, the question I asked was, how did this guy ever end up, when I say this guy, the key defendant in that case, how did he ever end up on the police department? And I was given the explanation. And I said, look, we have to have psychological tests for people before they become members of this department. That is something that's very, very important. So under my watch, the police department now, for applicants for the police department, all undergo psychological testing to make sure that they're suited. This is a difficult job, and it's a very important job. It's a very challenging job. It's not a job for everybody. And so I felt it was very, very important for us to have that psychological testing in place. So that's one significant change that has happened. several years later, I worked with the Fire and Police Commission and the then police chief, and we've instituted the practice now for cameras. And you've seen around the nation the challenges that we have had with the body cameras. But I'm a firm believer that the body cameras are there to help the public, but also to help the police officers, that because you're going to have a recorded history, if you will, of what transpired, it helps both parties. And it particularly helps good people. When I say good people, I mean the people from the community who have done nothing wrong and the police officers who have done nothing wrong. If someone has violated the law, that's going to show up on the video. If the police officer violates the law, that's going to show up on the video. So I think that that's another significant change. A third change that came about, and this happened after the shooting at for Dr. Hamilton in Red Arrow Park, we instituted, with the help of the Greater Milwaukee Foundation, better de-escalation training and more training, actually for more mental health type procedures that officers could follow. And the debate at that time was whether only officers who wanted to have this training should have it, or whether all officers should have it. And I felt that all officers should have it, because you don't know who's going to be interacting with the public. So those are just three examples of reforms that are being discussed in other parts of the country that are already here. Now, having said all that, I know we have, as a police department, a long way to go. And we have seen incidents, oftentimes incidents involving African-American men, where there is an overreaction. And I think that we have to have more training. This is one of the reasons that I feel so passionately about having the members of our police department and our fire department be members of our community. I want them to be members of our community, because if people believe that our police officers are an occupying force that is not part of this community, that hampers our ability to have better police community relations. And that obviously happened as a result of a change in state law under Governor Walker, where now probably close to half of our police officers don't even reside in the city of Milwaukee. And I think that that's a problem.
Well, and something that we've seen right now, as we've had protesters and activists on the street, you know, they've been frustrated by the Milwaukee Police Department's response to pretty peaceful protests. There was at least one incident of officers firing tear gas and rubber bullets at protesters. How are you responding right now to this use of police force?
I made it clear to the police chief, I've made it clear publicly, that I do not think that rubber bullets should be, that they are wrong to be used to disperse crowds. I've said that tear gas should only be used in very, very, very serious situations. Again, not with peaceful protesters. And I shared that with the police chief. And to my knowledge, that has not happened since I shared that with the police chief. You'll have to check with him on that. But there was an incident on roughly 6th and Reservoir, perhaps. And I saw the video of that. And I publicly stated my unhappiness with that, because I think that, have we seen some people who have acted inappropriately? Yes. And we should be mindful that the police officers have a very difficult job. But I think by and large, we have seen very peaceful protests, particularly during the day. We've had some issues at night, and we continue to have issues with reckless driving that has emanated at some of these areas. And that remains a concern. But I think that's more of a local police concern that we see in the summertime. But I think that people have the right, and not I think, I know people have the right under the First Amendment to have peaceful protests, and I support that.
You know, you said you shared these concerns with the police department, but do you have the power to make them stop, using tear gas and rubber bullets?
Well, as you may know, a lot of the Milwaukee is a little bit of an unusual structure in that I am not the boss of the police chief or the police department. We have a citizen board, the Fire and Police Commission, that oversees the police department as well as the fire department. And they're the ones that have rules that they put into place. Again, what I did was I shared my belief with the police chief, and I'm pleased that since I said that, my understanding is we have not had any use of rubber bullets, and we have not had any use of tear gas. And I think that's significant. And again, that goes back. Now, it was the Tuesday night after the first weekend where we saw so much activity.
Well, and this gets to a bigger question that I think a lot of us have. Police accountability is something we've been talking about for a long time, but it feels like little has happened there. When we're talking about police accountability, what are the real impediments to getting that kind of accountability? Because it seems like there are always roadblocks.
Well, I looked at what happened in Minneapolis and the defendant in the case in Minneapolis, and I saw that he had had something like 18 complaints against him in 18 years. And I thought, oh my God, how does this guy remain on the force? And I honestly don't believe an individual like that would be on the force in Milwaukee. And I'm going to do more work, again, just to review what our complaint procedure is, make sure that we don't allow that to happen. I don't believe, and this is why I've said that I'm going to get a group together that's going to look at our police practices so that I can make sure that I've got the exact information that I need to make recommendations, to work with the Fire and Police Commission, to work with the community group that's been formed in relation to the ACLU lawsuit, so that we have a really solid path forward to deal with issues that are not resolved here in the city of Milwaukee. And that's something that I'm committed to.
Yeah, you know, you just mentioned, I believe it was last week, Friday, you announced the creation of a commission called a Commission on Police Accountability and Reform. We've heard from a number of activists who've said that they don't know what this commission is. Just for clarity, was this commission created unilaterally by your administration, or is it the result of collaboration with community members?
I can give you the history of it. I can give you the very short history of it. Last week, when I saw some of the events that occurred, and I started asking questions about them from people in law enforcement, people new law enforcement, I was told that this practice or that practice was something that was approved at the federal level, the state level, the local level. And I thought, well, that might be one of the issues here. Are some of the practices that are well-accepted practices, are they practices that we should continue, even if they are approved at the federal level or the state level or the local level? And I thought, I've got to bring together a group that can look into this and give me some good advice. It's not unusual that you'd want to have something like that happen. But the next morning, that was maybe Wednesday, the next morning I woke up and I saw that the mayor of Atlanta sent out a tweet, actually. And in it, she said, "Thank you, President Obama. I accept your challenge. We will form a commission to look at our police practices here in Atlanta." And then I saw Washington, D.C. had done it, and I saw other communities had done it. And I went to the video and saw that President Obama was issuing a challenge to mayors across the nation to look at these practices. And quite honestly, I thought, President Obama has the moral force to be a counterweight to the complete lack of leadership we're seeing from President Trump on this. And this gives me an opportunity to do what I had been thinking about doing anyway, and to be doing it hopefully in conjunction with some of the advice I can get on the national level, as well as the local level, as to how we can move our police department forward. So I issued an executive order creating it. And my goal is to complement the work that's been done. There's been a number of community groups and community committees out there. So this is the goal here is to build on the work that they've done. And again, to move the city forward. And I don't think anybody would be surprised to hear that the mayor wants to be engaged in this and lead the effort to improve the police department.
Yeah, I guess one of the questions that we've heard from activists in particular is, you know, Milwaukee already has the Community Collaborative Committee. It also has the Fire and Police Commission. Why create a new group? Why not strengthen the power of either of those existing groups?
Well, I think this goes back to your first question, that there is a sense out there that there hasn't been enough that's been done. I think that was underlying what the first part of our conversation is, people are frustrated. I can tell you I'm frustrated. I'm frustrated. And I'm just not the type of person who's going to just wring his hands. I think that as the mayor of the city, I think I'm in a unique position to bring all of these groups together. And I think that's an important role for a mayor of any city, not just to bring the groups together. And that's what I'm hoping to accomplish. So again, I see this as adding to what the fine work that has been done, not in any way detracting from any work that anybody has done.
Okay. So, you know, you mentioned a lot of cities are creating these kinds of commissions, committees. A lot of major cities are also looking at defunding the police. Here in Milwaukee, activists are requesting some big budget cuts. Is that something the city is really considering?
Well, again, we've got a unique situation here where last year, I think that the police budget went up, and I don't have the numbers in front of me, but it's about a $300 million budget. And let's just say for the sake of conversation that it went up $4 or $5 million. And again, I don't have the numbers in front of me. That increase of $4 to $5 million translated into a reduction in the number of police officers of 60 police officers. In other words, we had the budget that the council passed had 60 fewer police officers for 2020 than it did for 2019. And as I said at the time, and I'll say it again, that was not a philosophical decision, that was a fiscal decision. We simply did not have the money to maintain the strength of the police department at the level we had in 2019. I would like to tell you that the city coffers are in a better shape this year than last year, but that's not the case. In fact, they're in a much more precarious situation going into the 2021 budget than they were going into the 2020 budget, in large part because of COVID-19, in large part because of our relationship with the state. And so this is a situation where probably no one's going to be happy, because it will be virtually impossible, I think, at this stage for us to maintain the strength of the police department exactly where it is right now. And so when I say unhappy, I think that there's a hope, and I would share this hope. We'd love to be able to put more money into other programs, but we've got some very serious fiscal problems that the city's facing right now. So that's before you even get to the conversation about defunding or anything like that. We've got the real world to deal with right now, which is a huge loss of revenue because of COVID-19, some challenges we have with our pension system, some other challenges that we face. So it's far more complicated than saying fund or defund, because we really know that we've got some serious fiscal challenge.
You know, you said it was a fiscal decision, not a philosophical decision. Are you interested in making that philosophical decision? Because I think that's kind of at the heart of this movement, the desire to make that philosophical decision.
And I think that that's a really important debate to have. And I certainly think that there are some places where we should not have or expect our police officers to do what they're doing. And I'll use as examples the changes we've had in mental health laws over the years. The police have in many ways become the front line workers in our mental health system. Very expensive, very inefficient. And if we put more resources into mental health issues, I think that would allow us not to have police officers sitting in a car with an individual for hours on end waiting for them to be accepted at a hospital, for example. Or things like that. I think the question of police officers in schools, I think that you're going to see changes there. And I think then the burden is going to be on those of us in power to say, okay, how are we going to deal with the safety concerns? And when I say safety concerns, I'm not even talking about students and other students. I'm talking about people from the adults coming into schools. What are we going to do there? But I do think when you talk about basic police services, we know that And this is the challenge we have in parts of the city where people feel that the police don't treat them well. And that's a legitimate fear or concern that they have, are also the parts of the city where we get the most calls for service. And so it becomes a very challenging dynamic that if someone is breaking into your home, or if a woman is raped, or if there's reckless driving, who do you call? And I think that's a debate we need to have as a city. That's a debate we need to have as a society. Calls for police for domestic violence is something that happens a lot, and they're considered very dangerous calls for the police to respond to. If we're not going to have police responding to those calls, do we simply as a society not respond to those calls? Who do we send instead to those calls, knowing that they can be very dangerous? But those are all, I think, really important parts of this conversation that we need to have.
Mayor Tom Barrett has been the mayor of Milwaukee since 2004, and he was just reelected to his fifth term in office earlier this year. He spoke with Lake Fex Joy Powers over Zoom from his home here in the city, and you can hear their full conversation at WUWM.com. Coming up next, an epidemiologist gives her advice on how to protest safely in light of the coronavirus pandemic. Lake Effect Weekend continues in a moment on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect Weekend continues on WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. The demonstrations erupting around the city and the world have brought thousands of people into the streets. They're chanting, singing, and shouting in protest of police brutality. And as each word is articulated, they're spreading minuscule water droplets into the air. That's a problem. While people are gathering and protesting, we're still in the middle of a global pandemic. So how can people demonstrate while maintaining their safety? Dr. Laura Cassidy is the research director for the Institute for Health and Equity at the Medical College of Wisconsin. She joins Lake Fex Joy Powers to talk about the health concerns associated with these demonstrations and gives her tips on how to stay safe while protesting.
So my first question is a pretty simple one. When you're looking at these protests here in Milwaukee, what are your initial concerns regarding this pandemic?
My initial reactions are that the virus is still out there, and we've done a good job of containing it. We've all been so responsible and have protected each other and looked out for each other, but it's still there, and we know it passes from person to person. That's the only way it can be transmitted. So at first, I do feel a little bit of concern, and when we gather in crowds, it can pass faster. People are not always 6 feet apart, and a lot of people wore masks, but a lot of people didn't, and we need to make sure they wear them correctly. So my first concern was about the disease being transmitted from person to person.
Yeah. And of course, you know, I was at one of the marches. People were, most of them were wearing masks, but a lot of people are not 6 feet apart. People are, in some cases, shoulder to shoulder. When it comes to wearing masks, staying far apart, how good are these things at controlling the spread when you're already in a large group like this?
Right. So staying apart and wearing masks and washing our hands are some of the few ways we have to really control the virus. The good news is people were outside, so that's better than being inside. And they were wearing masks, which helps protect other people, but it doesn't protect you 100%. The other thing is when they're protesting, you're yelling, you're singing, you're chanting, and that causes the droplets to go farther. So that was a concern as well. And also people tend to put their masks on and off to talk or touch their face because of the mask, and that can actually promote spreading.
So what are some of the tips that you have for people who are walking in the protest, especially to make sure that they're staying as safe as possible while demonstrating?
Right. That's a really good question, because doing this safely is so important right now because it could affect our more vulnerable populations in the long run. So when you're walking, you know, put your arms out at arm length and try and make sure there's at least both arm lengths away from everybody. At least you're going in one direction so you're not face to face. Wear your masks and bring hand sanitizer.
You know, I've seen a lot more cars trailing the protests than what I normally see. You know, they have signs, sometimes they have supplies for people. Is that a safer way to protest in a vehicle like that?
Well, it might be safer as far as transmitting disease, and if they're good drivers and they don't get in a car accident, of course, and wear seatbelts. I am an epidemiologist. However, if people are packing into cars and not wearing masks, then they're in a confined space where they could infect each other.
Okay. As far as supplies go, you know, we've seen a lot of people who are handing out water and things. I'm not sure if everybody is taking the kind of precaution of washing off things as they hand them to one another or start taking sips from things. How big is the risk of getting COVID-19 from touching something that somebody else who might be infected has touched?
Well, we do know now that the primary mode of transmission is person to person through droplets. However, you know, the virus can live on objects for a certain amount of time. So if somebody were infected with the virus and perhaps did not know they had it and were asymptomatic and sneezed or coughed or yelled and got droplets on the bottle, there is potential that if the next person took that bottle and touched their face, they could get infected.
But it's less of a concern than the person-to-person contact?
I think it's less likely, but it's still a concern.
Okay. So this is something we actually talked a bit about before the interview began. Police have been throwing tear gas canisters at people, and there's been a concern among some health professionals that this is increasing the chances of contracting coronavirus. Do you know why that would be?
You know, that's a really great question. And I don't think right now there's any data on it or research on it. But just if you think about it logically, if tear gas is being thrown, probably the first reaction is to wipe your eyes, perhaps to remove your mask or move it around. And it also creates chaos, where people might bump into each other, they might touch each other more, they may be running. And also, I don't know the effect of the tear gas on the lungs and if it would make people more likely to get ill.
And certainly they'd be more likely to start coughing up.
Yes, I do believe you're right about that.
So we had been talking a lot about contact tracing, something that we've wanted to start more of to really understand how this disease is spreading. But right now, we have a situation where there are thousands of people gathering in cities around the country. How could that impact contact tracing?
Yes, so this is a unique situation where we have a pandemic and we have crowds assembling. And if you look at a lot of the outbreaks across the country, they're due to crowding. New York City, people live so close together. Nursing homes, meatpacking plants. So this is an area where people are crowding, and they may not know the people around them that they could be spreading the disease to or getting it from. So this is going to make it very challenging. And I think one of the keys is if you've been at one of these protests and you know of somebody who has tested positive for COVID, then please be proactive, go get tested, self-quarantine till you get the results. If you're feeling any symptoms, get tested and self-quarantine so that we don't continue to spread it. And do the best you can to report it and help with the contact tracing. But when you don't know, when you've been in a big crowd, you don't know the people you've been in contact with. I think, you know, if people are willing to share that they have been at the protest, that might help in some way.
Well, Dr. Cassidy, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing your work.
And thank you so much. And, you know, I think this is a really important time in our lives, and I encourage people to be as safe as possible about this. And it's our responsibility, each one of us, to try to control this virus in these times.
Dr. Laura Cassidy is the research director for the Institute for Health and Equity at the Medical College of Wisconsin and the director of the PhD program in Public and Community Health and the Division of Epidemiology. She spoke with Lake Vextroy Powers. You can also find all of our coverage of Milwaukee's demonstrations at WUWM.com. Coming up next, the latest episode of Bubbler Talk examines death in nursing homes due to COVID-19 outbreaks. Lake Effect Weekend continues on WUWM. Lake Effect Weekend continues on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski.
Bubbler Talk, quenching Milwaukee's thirst for knowledge.
This is Angelina Mosier Salazar. COVID-19 has disrupted many parts of our lives, but it's also affecting us in death. This week on Bubbler Talk, we're looking at the toll the pandemic has played in one of Milwaukee's most vulnerable populations, the elderly. Many who contract the coronavirus are dying and are dying alone. One of those people is Sophie Lang. She is described by her son Mark Lang as an avid gardener and a dedicated mother. She was 93 years old when she passed away from complications of COVID-19.
If you looked up the word mom in the dictionary, her face was there. Her picture was there.
Miss Lang was a resident of Hales Corners Care Center in Greenfield. She had been there since last year after she suffered an injury. At the facility, she was receiving physical therapy in hopes of eventually making a recovery and going home. But then the pandemic hit and she and other nursing home residents were on lockdown. Family and friends could no longer visit their loved ones.
I couldn't send flowers because they didn't want to receive flowers. Couldn't send candy, couldn't send food. So I bought 7 Mother's Day cards. Okay? And every day I mailed them to her.
It was shortly after Mother's Day when Miss Lang tested positive for the coronavirus and became sick. About a week later, she passed. For Mark, her son, the most difficult part wasn't her death.
What I was mostly sad about was that I wasn't able to be there when she took her last breath.
Mark says he had sworn to himself that he'd be at his mom's side when she died, after not being present when his father and brother passed. But he wasn't able to keep that promise. Mark is not alone. According to the State Department of Health Services, 286 residents of long-term care facilities have died in Wisconsin, and presumably most of them without the companionship of their loved ones. The restriction on visitors has been in place since mid-March. Bubbler Talk listener Keith Goggins wanted to know more about the deaths in nursing homes from COVID-19 and prompted this WUWM investigation. But DHS refused to release the names of nursing homes with coronavirus outbreaks until federal authorities announced they would publish them. In a statement, DHS said, "Our decision to release the names of facilities with positive cases allows us to maintain confidentiality while providing peace of mind to families and guardians who cannot visit their loved ones." But DHS today is still declining to say how many residents have been infected or died at each facility. I contacted Ms. Lang's nursing home, Hales Corners Care Center, to ask about positive cases and deaths there, but I did not receive a response, nor did I hear back from 10 other facilities that I reached out to for this story. But I did speak with David Mills, CEO of North Shore Healthcare, a network of 54 nursing homes in Wisconsin. Mills says at his facilities, residents who become ill are not required to stay.
The residents absolutely have the right to be discharged and go home and be cared for at home by a loved one or home care or some other service. And that is absolutely within their right, and we would support that.
But unfortunately, Mills says visits to nursing homes are still not allowed because of the risk to both the patients and family members. Miss Lang's son, Mark, says he wishes he would have been given the opportunity to be with his mother before she passed. To him, dying alone is the worst way anyone could die.
I've had dreams. Honestly, I've had a couple dreams a month ago that I had her is calling out my name saying, "Mark, where are you? I need you." You know, that's a heavy burden.
In an effort to give the public a better understanding of the impact of COVID-19, WUWM obtained data from the Milwaukee County Medical Examiner's Office, and we used it to create a map that shows all the nursing homes with multiple COVID-19 deaths in the county. You can find the interactive map on our website at WUWM.com. Angelina Mosier Salazar, 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Support for Bubbler Talk comes from Sun Badger Solar. What have you always wanted to know about the Milwaukee area? Visit WUWM.com/bubblertalk to submit your question.
We'll take one last break and then return with the local photographer about what it's been like documenting the protests in Milwaukee. Like Effect Weekend continues on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect Weekend continues on Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Civil rights protesters are continuing to march around the country and here in Milwaukee against police brutality. The way many people are connecting with the demonstrations is through the videos and photographs from people on the ground. At WUWM, our reporters have been aided by photographer and videographer Sam Ergani, who has been out at the protests nearly every day working to capture what's been happening in our city. To learn more about his experience out in the field during these marches, he joins me now. Sam Ergani, welcome to Lake Effect.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Before we get into your recent work, I'm curious as to what drew you to photography in the first place as a profession.
Well, I went to a high school called Ronald Wilson Reagan International Baccalaureate High School here in Milwaukee. And they had this very extensive art program for students to graduate high school with art credits moving into to university. And they had a lot of cooperative programs with schools like MIAD and schools like Cardinal Stritch. And I ended up falling in love with art, but I didn't necessarily have the hand for crafting, for painting, things like that. And I ended up renting a school camera, and I kind of fell in love with the idea of documenting what I saw. So after I graduated high school, I went to Cardinal Stritch for almost a year. Transferred to UWM, both pursuing photojournalism degrees. And just before, right when I was starting to like complete graduation, like right when I saw it in like my mind's eye, I got hired by Apple. And I worked part-time as a technician and then a lead at Apple, which was great. I learned so many people skills and things about art and technology that I feel like I never would have necessarily had access to if I didn't take that leap. And doing that kind of granted me not only the fiscal opportunity to like buy equipment that that would take me to the next level, but it afforded me the time and space to become like an amateur photographer leading into a professional photographer. So while I was working at Apple, I used that time to document, you know, my friends that were in bands and my friends that were like hip hop artists in the Milwaukee scene. And that kind of just snowballed into where I am today in a nutshell.
Yeah, so your work includes music photography, like you just mentioned, also portraiture, abstract. So how would you say you describe your body of work and how you came to your identity within those mediums of photography?
I think it kind of manifested itself. I definitely have a deep love for like everything, nature and landscape and everything that the world provides to us that is still organic and not artificial. But when I saw all these artists around me, because I love going to shows, I love bands like Paper Hound, I love Shelly Berry and like Kellen and Sister String, so I would go to these shows pretty avidly anyways, but I realized that these people deserve like professional work. They need to make sure that they're being seen, and shooting landscape photography as like a passion and then shooting artists in Milwaukee as a dedication just started to go hand in hand in those two forms of mediums where I was like shooting in low light with landscape and shooting in low light at these venues. Those lines just started to blur and it all just started to become one to me. And I realized that my style just kind of manifested itself as I started doing more and like just trying to become a better artist, so to speak, within myself.
So being able to capture and set the scene at shows and portraiture is vastly different compared to throwing yourself out into protests. So what compelled you to get out and capture the protests happening in Milwaukee?
I felt as partially as a community leader and as an artist and as a person of color, it was my responsibility to go out there and document and bring visibility to what was happening. But more so in comparison to a show, the energy is the same, the passion is the same, the people that are there, it's all the same. And since through COVID, I haven't been able to do community work, and I haven't been able to bring positivity to the community like I'm used to. And like, and that's something that I want to do. It's something I really pride myself on doing. So being able to do that now, as terrible as these events that have led up to this have been, I just feel it's my responsibility. It's truly my duty to be out there and bring visibility to who we are and what we're trying to accomplish as a greater community.
And what is that image that you want to share with people, specifically those who don't live in Milwaukee? As outside viewers are looking at protests happening around the country, what is it about Milwaukee that you wanted to capture?
Well, Milwaukee is one of the most segregated cities in the United States. And I think if we're not bringing visibility to these peaceful protests and the message that we're trying to send, then I feel like we're just entirely missing the mark as a community here in Milwaukee. All these people that are in these streets they're all different types of artists. They're all different types of entrepreneurs. There are kids out there, and we're trying to lead a better generation for these kids. And these protests truly are peaceful. There's truly no doubt about that. And I march alongside these people with my camera in hand to show everyone that's staring at us, and to show the police that we're not afraid to document what happens here, because we have no ill intention. We're not the ones who have guns.
And in an age where everyone is out in the protests with their cell phones, everyone has the ability to capture a moment. But what do you think makes a good shot?
In times like these, I think quality. And I think cell phones, the best camera is always going to be the camera that you have on you. But if we can make sure that some of these injustices that are happening at these peaceful protests are documented in high quality, then there's no debate to what's happening or what had happened at that event. There's no UFO quality of what's happening. There's no room for speculation. And I think it's our duty as photographers and videographers to document and bring visibility. It's also our duty to protect the identity of the protesters. And I found myself really struggling on that line. And I've been having a hard time finding what to post and how to keep our community energized moving forward. But I think those lines will start to define themselves as we continue moving forward as a community, as we continue building rules for ourselves that are all inclusive and that are very protecting, not only of ourselves, but people on the other side as well.
Yeah, as you mentioned, there is a growing movement that calls for journalists and citizens to blur or not show protesters' faces. And even though Milwaukee's protests have been peaceful, obviously going in when the protests initially started, as things continue, what are you going to try to do or keep in mind or strategically set up shots? Like, have you decided that you're going to try and have no people's faces on there? And granted, like, a lot of protesters are wearing masks as well. So I'm curious how you feel in that debate, and you're immersing yourself in these protests also.
I've been doing my best to just take pictures of the backs of people's heads and their signs. And the only pictures of faces I've been trying to get are of the protest leaders and our community leaders who are happy and willing to share who they are and what they stand for. I've been sitting on hundreds of photos over the last week from the first 2 days that I haven't posted or anything, because I'm fearful that I may be doing wrong to our community. And I think what these protests have done in comparison to different movements in the past, it's brought people from all walks of life together. And I think people are truly afraid of stepping out of that comfort zone and really trying to fight for something good when they haven't in the past. And any sort of level of comfort that we can bring to people, or any sort of protection that we can bring to these people, I think is most important. So if that means I'm shooting for nothing, that's fine. If that means I'm documenting just for myself until the right thing comes along, I think that's also fine. I think what's important is we're bringing people together and we're making them feel safe.
I know there, like you mentioned, there's hundreds of photographs that you took of protesters moving throughout the city of Milwaukee, but do any specific shots come to mind or stand out to you, either because of how they turned out or because of what was happening when you were able to capture that moment?
Yeah, I think on day one, I captured a woman who was being arrested when we protested on the highway just off of North Avenue. And there was another gentleman that I took a photo of, and he had a shirt that just said, "I can't breathe." And there was a crowd of people behind him. And I think those two photos are, they're of very different people, two very different people from different walks of life. But the unity that they both shared that same day was very important to me. And I think those two photos were very, very, they contrasted each other, but they sent the same message. And I think that was very important.
This is a historical moment, not just because of the protest, but it's also one that's happening in the midst of a pandemic. So when you're out shooting during the protests with masses of people gathering, you know, do you have concerns for your safety either due to COVID or the potential risk that protests like others around the country could potentially turn from being peaceful?
I do fear for my health and I fear for my family's health, but at a certain point, we have to fight for what's right. My fear is maybe the big cats want us to all get sick. And this is just an easy way for us all to get over with COVID as fast as possible. But it's a lingering fear that kind of never goes away. It looms quite like debt does. But, you know, I'm handing out masks and gloves and we're all hand sanitizing as best we can. And like I said, top of mind is keeping us all safe and making sure everyone feels safe and protected. And we're all, I can tell that we're all doing our part, but there is a large cloud of fear, I think, that surrounds all of us when we go to these protests. But what's stronger than our fear is our will to fight for change.
What was your main takeaway being a photographer, not just observing, but being a part of these protests? And what do you want people to feel when they look at your photos?
I think my main takeaway is that my main takeaway was that no journalist is safe any longer. The lines of how journalists were protected are no longer there, which means that journalists share the same right as the people in the protests do. Like we're all there together. I hope that when people see my photos that they feel inspired to act, whether that's donate money or food, whether that's sharing information, whether that's coming to the protest, if they can and they're able. I just hope it energizes the community and it continues to energize the community, because if we have 200 days ahead of us, we all have a lot of work to do. And I just hope to be a part of that flagship to keep people energized, keep people safe, keep people feeling protected, and to keep people fighting for the right cause.
How did this experience impact you the first day you went out, and how do you continue to feel it impacting you as things continue?
I've been stewing on that thought for quite some time. And when I first started documenting the music scene, when I first saw an artist like Kellen Classic, I teared up, I cried because of how emotionally powerful his message was on stage. And when I saw Sista Strings for the first time, I cried because of the message that they were sending through their music and through who they were and what they stood for. And I felt the same about Nickel and Rose. And when I went to that first day of the George Floyd protest, I felt that same impact. I felt that rush of energy in my chest. I felt those tears and I felt that emotion. And I'm trying to hold on to that feeling so that when 10 more days pass and 10 more days pass, that I know that I'm still trying to do the right thing. And it hit me like a ton of bricks in the best way possible.
Well, I know your photos continue to do the same for others looking at them. So, Sam Argani, thank you for your work, and thank you for taking the time to speak with me about it.
Yeah, this has been a dream come true. Thank you.
Sam Argani is a photographer and videographer in Milwaukee, and you can see more of his work at WUWM.com. Along with the discussions and marches for Black Lives Matter, another phrase people are learning more about is white privilege. It's a term that refers to the inherent advantages that come from being white in a culture with pervasive and enduring racial inequality. As a white man, our poetry contributor Sean Rampt has been reflecting on the recent protests, and he asks other white people to do the same. Here he is reading his poem titled Privilege.
Now I'm going to read a poem that I wrote entitled Privilege in a bit here. But first, I wanted to say a couple of things about it. All I ask is that you keep these things in mind while listening to the poem. Everybody knows that white people myself included, obviously, have benefited from privilege their entire lives. We don't need to keep telling everybody that because they've told us that for decades, for centuries. It's clear, it's fact, everybody knows it. So beyond acknowledging that, what are you doing? If you can protest, great, but if you are protesting, please do so knowing that you're there to support the Black community, not to pat yourselves on the back. If you're unable to protest, fine, donate. There are several bail funds you can donate to, Black Lives Matter chapters, countless other links, Black-owned businesses, anything to help. Share those links. Let people know where they can donate. There are several resources you can find online or buy to learn, to educate yourself on everything the Black community has had to deal with for hundreds of years. But I think the most important thing is to stop asking Black people to tell you what you can do, what we can do. We've been told. For hundreds of years, we've been told. Everything is online. You don't need to ask them to do the work for you. We have to do the work ourselves. So as you're listening to this poem, please just think about how what we're saying and what we're doing, if that's enough. And please just think about how our entire lives have been a lot easier because of the skin we were born into. Don't forget that. This is privilege. Privilege is being able to say all lives matter while living out your day, while being without fear, while breathing without care as another struggles for air. They deflect from injustice. They remove from confrontation. Those three words, just a vicious reaction to those who simply want to be treated as human. Privilege is being able to wake up without constant dread in the back of your head. Privilege is being able to write this without ever knowing how dangerous it is just to breathe, just to be. Passive discomfort isn't an excuse for silence. Potential confrontation isn't an excuse for injustice. Privilege is being able to choose to do nothing. But yet, you tell yourself those three words, all lives matter, because you don't have to care, because you don't have to fear. They serve as a blanket, shielding you from the grim reality that dares to alter your ideals. Disingenuous at best, irreparably harmful at worst. That's privilege. We see the faces, we hear the voices, but we choose silence because it soothes, and it's long past time to convert comfort into confrontation. Privilege is being able to decide that you don't have to decide. And that's power you can't buy.
Sean Rampt is a poetry contributor for Like Effect, and you can find more of his work at WUWM.com. And that wraps up the show for today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thanks for making us a part of your afternoon. Lake Effect Weekend airs every Saturday and Sunday from 3 to 4. That's right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee's NPR.